Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
They keep telling us we should give them time to address the situation. And that time it has practically run out.
The Nigerian National Labour Congress announces plans for an indefinite nationwide strike beginning Tuesday.
When lockdown came and so many other organisations were considering, what do I do? We went virtual 100% with a flick of a switch.
The CEO of the United States International Development Finance Corporation, or DFC, expresses optimism about the bank's performance.
Helping build resilient healthcare systems through our financing of private sector opportunities is one of our key priorities.
And the African Union appoints Ibrahim Mayaki as its special envoy for food systems. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the National Labour Congress has announced plans for an indefinite nationwide strike beginning Tuesday. The action, it says, is to protest the decision of President Bola Tinubu to remove the fuel subsidy. This despite local media reports of a last-minute attempt by the government for an emergency meeting between leaders of the labour union and the chief of staff of the president, Femi Gbajabiamila. Union leaders, the reports say, refused to attend the meeting, contending the government did not give enough notice. The representatives of the labor union argue that the subsidy removal and the lack of plans to cushion the effect on workers is forcing the group to embark on the strike. Emmanuel Ogbuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labor Congress. He tells me that the government must act to alleviate the suffering of Nigerian workers.
You recall that on May 29th, the President Bola Ahmed Tinubu, in his inaugural speech, made a very profound statement that subsidy is gone. So we have a situation in the country where we have a consensus on the fact that the policy has brought untold hardship to Nigerians. We are also on the same force with government on the fact that they have done nothing to mitigate this hardship. They keep telling us we should give them time to address the situation. And that time it has practically run out because 4 months down the lane, workers have become destitute.
Some Nigerians are saying that, what is it with this Labour Congress's decision to stop again, go back again, strike? It's confusing to Nigerians, they say.
So anybody saying it's confusing, it's clearly not in tone with social dialogue mechanism. We have only had, since this happened, 2 days warning strike. We've not had any other strike. We had a one-day protest to drive home the point that the government needed to fuel the pressure this is causing on people. When that didn't get the desired attention, we gave a 2-day warning strike notice and embarked on the warning strike. And still government refused to do anything. And all government tells is give us time. Anybody saying that is confusing to them must definitely not be a Nigerian, or he belongs to the elite that are causing this havoc.
Mano, I understand that on Friday, the chief of staff of the president summoned a meeting. How did the meeting go? How did it go, and why are you barreling ahead despite the meeting?
Well, there was no meeting. There was no meeting. We don't work in the chief of staff's office. So if people are going to have meetings, there are procedures. We have labor leaders that stay all over the country. We don't work inside the presidential villa. So if you are going to call for a meeting of this magnitude, then you give people adequate notice. There was no meeting on Friday.
The leaders of the group and your national executives have directed the state chapters and affiliates to mobilize for the shutdown of critical facilities and infrastructure, including the airport, seaport, electricity grids, and fuel supply nationwide. Basically, you are grinding Nigeria to a halt. Is that the aim?
You are talking about where people work. We're saying workers who can't afford to continue to suffer this should proceed on strike. So the places you have called are populated by workers. Yeah. So if the worker is unable to go to work, there's nothing we can do about that.
What's the next line of action after you embark on this strike?
So if the government is not able to govern, then they should hand over the reins of government to the trade unions. The workers would then know how to utilize the income that is coming from the country to distribute it equitably to Nigerians. That's what the essence of governance is. The essence of governance is the well-being of the people, not a few people enjoying and then you are solving the problems on the back of a majority of the people. That cannot be governance. They must show that they are willing to govern, and that hasn't reflected yet.
Emmanuel Ogbuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations is calling for strong multilateral relationships to solve pressing challenges around the world, including climate change and the war in Ukraine. Patricia Scotland, who made the call during the recent UN General Assembly in New York, expressed hope that the global community will address the threat posed by exogenous shocks, which she adds need a response. The remarks come as observers call for a solution to the climate crisis and the need to resolve the Ukraine war, which they say is having a toll on supply chains, causing economic challenges to the less wealthy nation. I sat down with Patricia Scotland on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Topics included Scotland's hopes for the UN high-level debate, the outcome of the Commonwealth Foreign Affairs and Environment Ministers meeting, as well as why her organization is attracting non-English-speaking countries that have applied to join the group. Here is the concluding part of the conversation.
COP28 is coming up. Your hopes, aspirations, expectations, outcomes that could solve problems. And lastly, a bird whispered to me that a lot of countries that are traditionally not Commonwealth are willing to join. What makes the Commonwealth so attractive for these countries to want to join?
I think what makes the Commonwealth so attractive is we are incredibly practical. We, as you know, are not an organization joined by treaty. We're joined by values. And our members are being absolutely clear that we need to come together. We need to share everything we know that works, everything that we know does not work. And we're trying to only spend a dollar once. So if one of us has spent the money and we know it works, we share it. If one of us has spent the money and it has not worked, we're sharing it. And this coming together, this sharing of knowledge, this practical application, is meaning that our countries are doing perhaps a little better, not because they're richer, not because they are better in any other sense other than their willingness to collaborate, to work together, and to change the paradigm that we're all seeking. And the thing is, we know no one can do this on our own. None of us, no matter how big we are, we don't have enough money. And yet the five regions who are represented in our Commonwealth, 21 of them are from Africa, across six oceans, our very difference turns us into like a little petri dish where we can grow solutions, we can innovate, and that is what's attracting people. If you look at the Mo Ibrahim Index of good governance in Africa, you'll see that our 21 countries are basically in the top two categories of good governance. And that's attracting people. They're attracting as to why did our Commonwealth continue to grow in our economy when so many others took a nosedive? Because we did grow through COVID, which was counterintuitive. And why did we grow? Because the digital trade with women and young people, that grew. And digital trade, when you're locked down, depends on trust. So our countries trust each other. We have the same language. We share the same legal structure, similar parliamentary systems, similar institutions, which makes us recognizable, which developed our 21% advantage in trading. And so people are looking at that and saying, what are they doing? And why are they better able to survive than we? And it comes down to partnership. It comes down to pragmatism. It comes down to trust. And we have built that trust. And during the Commonwealth meetings, we were able to continue that partnership virtually, even though we didn't see each other and we had to go virtual from March 2020. But the Commonwealth Secretariat was ready. And I remember when we started to look at what we were going to do and whether we were going to have BlueJeans or Zoom or Teams, people thought we were crazy. How could a multilateral organization prepare something? We were never going to be virtual, they said. But actually, I saw that the future was digital. I also saw that we needed a way to contact each other and to stay in touch, particularly because the sun doesn't set on our Commonwealth. So if we were going to come together, we'd do it. And this crazy idea that we should have an opportunity, a platform to communicate, meant that when lockdown came and so many other organizations were considering, what do? We went virtual 100% with a flick of a switch, and that saved us. And we were able to keep in close contact with our member states, helping them, supporting them, but much more importantly, actually, allowing them a vehicle through which they could support each other, bringing them together at a time of stress and difficulty, which made the difference. I'll never forget that we were the first meeting of health ministers in the margins of the WHO. And our ministers were really in a state of shock, but were totally determined that they would save the people of their countries. And they were willing to work together and do anything necessary. Now, when you go through really bad times, it creates a bond. And that bond of friendship and support, I was told, meant as much, if not more, almost, than the money. Because you felt people were standing with you, fighting by your side, giving you everything that they had so you could give them everything you had. And together, we were more than the sum of our parts. So I was incredibly proud of the Commonwealth.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. She spoke with me from New York.
Every week, VOA's Issues in the News discusses the biggest stories in detail. Our in-depth analysis goes beyond the headlines with the inside story on U.S. and international news. Issues in the News, every weekend on The Voice of America.
In New York, the CEO of the United States International Development Finance Corporation, or DFC, is expressing optimism about the group's performance after setting new records in a number of its projects around the world. Scott Nathan says in less than 2 years, the DFC has exceeded its $1 billion goal originally scheduled for 5 years. Established by Congress, the DFC's objective is to help mobilize funds in the developing world, including Africa, as part of the effort to impact and promote U.S. strategic interests. I sat out with Scott Nathan on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly in New York. We discussed a wide range of topics, including the scaling up of investment in solutions to critical global challenges such as boosting food security and healthcare.
And, you know, we're only about 4 years old. We're created by the U.S. Congress to better address challenges in the developing world, focus on the poorest countries in the world, help mobilize capital to the private sector to make development impact, and advance the strategic interests of the United States. In this time, we've increased our level of activity every year. We're finishing up a great fiscal year, be at the end of this month, and we're optimistic that we're going to set new records for number of projects financed, the total dollar amounts out the door, and really, and most importantly, the impact on global issues. You know, we're focused on providing reliable, sustainable access to energy, high quality infrastructure, healthcare systems, agriculture, support for small business, really the engine of economic growth in so many countries around the world. And we're doing this by providing financing across our range of products to the private sector with really the belief that that's a sustainable way to support development, have a thriving private sector that can help meet the needs of the people and countries around the world.
What would you say has been the progress report, and what are the monitoring mechanisms to see that where you are investing, it's yielding, the intended objectives are realized? What are those?
So that's so important. We set a high standard for our investments, whether that's environmental standards, social standards, labor. These kind of issues are incredibly important to us. And so we do deep analysis before making an investment. But as you mentioned, monitoring is key. Doing the analysis beforehand is not good enough. You need to see how the results turn out. So actually, the biggest group within our organization is the group that handles this kind of screening for those issues and then monitors and measures, having objective outcomes that we're looking to achieve and making sure that we're following through. Not everything works out. Not every investment is a good one, but we have a great track record. And the more we can have that virtuous cycle of setting goals, measuring the outcomes, incorporating those lessons into the next investment, the better off we'll be, the more impact we'll make, which is ultimately what it's all about.
Talk to me about the investment in healthcare and how it's going so far, because as you know, there are tropical diseases, people, there are not enough health centers to handle it. So with such an investment, I think it might go a long way in helping the individual countries. And what has been the responses of the government in partnering what you're doing?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, helping build resilient healthcare systems through our financing of private sector opportunities is one of our key priorities. You know, that was the case when DFC launched. But soon after DFC launched in 2019, we had the global pandemic. And the organization pivoted. This was before I was there, but the organization pivoted, found a variety of ways to really appropriately address that crisis. And that's from helping with vaccine manufacturing in a distributed way, helping with the distribution of vaccines once they're manufactured, making sure that the purchases of vaccines can be financed in a timely way, because the key is to get vaccines in an equitable and fair and extremely fast way out there as quickly as possible. And we worked hard on this by making investments in Senegal, in South Africa, in India, in vaccine manufacturing, and working with the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi, to make sure that they had the money necessary to put in orders. We helped them think about advancing money from donor commitments. But the lessons of the pandemic are that you need to have a resilient healthcare system. And so we're making investments far beyond just pandemic response and thinking about hospitals and clinics and therapeutics. These are key. There are lots of innovative businesses around the world that we can invest in that can help local communities be prepared for whatever crisis is to come in the future.
Scott Nathan is the CEO of the United States International Development Finance Corporation, or DFC. He spoke with me from New York. Faced with challenges of food security across the continent, the African Union recently appointed Ibrahim Mayaki as its special envoy for food systems. The move, analysts say, could help encourage African countries to expedite action towards improving agricultural production using innovation and new research. Observers say with a track record in governance, They expect the former Prime Minister of Niger, African leaders, stakeholders, agriculture, business, entrepreneurs, and the youth to come up with pragmatic solutions to help countries feed their people. This as the Atlantic Council launched a report entitled The Future of Food Security in Africa, the Agritech Solution. The report featured new research and offered recommendations using Agritech. Speakers at the event on the sideline of the UN General Assembly include Dr. Kari Fowler, Special Envoy for Global Food Security, and Dr. Ibrahim Mayaki, who is also the former Chief Executive Officer of the African Union Development Agency. For more about his role and what can be done to help African countries to embrace solutions towards food security, I had a sit-down interview with Dr. Ibrahim Mayaki.
So food systems are the key issue if we look at Africa's long-term. As you know, Africa will double its population according to the lowest scenarios by 2050. If we have difficulties in feeding currently 1.3 billion, how will we manage governance issues in 2050 with 2.5, 2.6 billion? So food security is critical, fundamental, not only in order to reduce poverty, but in order to increase wealth by transforming the small-scale farmers we have into micro, small, and medium entrepreneurs. That will be absolutely essential. So my role is to look at that long-term perspective, and from that long-term perspective and what is requested to feed those 2.x billion, analyze the tools that we currently have. What are we doing in terms of adaptation, climate change, adaptation, and agriculture? What are we doing in terms of agricultural inputs? What are we doing in terms of soil health? What are we doing in terms of nutrition? What are we doing in terms of trade?
As people say, Africa cannot always depend on others to feed them. So what has been the responses of them in terms of putting mechanisms of measures in place to ensure that their people are fed?
Yeah, that's a very important question. But they are more and more aware of the fact that political determination is key. Our food import bill is between $60 and $70 billion, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. These 60 to 70 billions, they come out of the pockets of ordinary Africans. So if we can spend $70 billion in importing food, why don't we reorient these resources to improve our production and our productivity? So policymakers are really sensitive to what all over the continent. You might have a few cases, but globally, the tools are in place. Now, there are two issues that we need to fix. The first one is to have the right enabling environment in terms of policies to attract the private sector and to transform these small-scale farmers, who are also private sector, in micro and small entrepreneurs of our continent.
Dr. Mayaki, you talked about the enabling environment that would make these, you know, small-scale farmers to grow, to create jobs for the rest of the young people. But is there a political will to create that enabling environment? Because more often than not, the young ones are raring to go. They are daring to go out. They are raring to make things happen. But sometimes there are political inhibitions that sometimes they say frustrates them. So as you push or engage these policymakers, do you see the political will to actualize the transformation of Africa food systems?
You are perfectly right. If you look at the USA and the role of farmers and how they pressure Congress during the farm bill discussions, you see that politicians are very sensitive to that because it has a cost. You look at Europe, one of the biggest budget of the European Union is farmers. So because they know it's very sensitive politically. So you are absolutely right. In our case, we have tended to neglect the small-scale farmers because they didn't have political weight. So it's a question of changing the power relationships. And once they are empowered, and they are, they will put pressure on the governments so that the policy reforms are done.
Dr. Ibrahim Mayaki is African Union's envoy for food systems. He spoke with me from New York. Kenyans would have to wait for the cost of living to go down as the government blames businesses for a rise in poverty and loss of economic power among families to purchase basic commodities. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
A report by the Kenya Institute for Public Policy Research and Analysis, or KIPRA, says inflation is the reason workers in Kenya are paid wages that aren't enough to feed, clothe and shelter them. The Kenya Economic Report 2023 says officials tried to reduce 2022's inflation rate of 9.6% to a range of 2.5 to 7.5%, the targeted range of Kenya's central bank. In 2022, low-income households experienced a challenging year due to the increased cost of living, according to KIPRA Director Ross Ngugi.
When food inflation is going up, then everybody is affected, and more so the low-income household, who spend about 60% of their income on food. So anytime food prices go up, then cost of living increases, and the low-income earners hit or bear a heavy burden.
The 2023 report says that most workers, 77%, earn less than the minimum wage, which covers approximately half of living costs. According to the Kenya Central Bank, inflation in 2022 was 7.66%, a 1.55% increase from the previous year. Kenyan Finance Minister Njuguna Ndung'u blames companies' appetite for monopoly and dominance, which reduces market competition.
The new administration is concerned with the problems that have led many Kenyans to sink into abject poverty. One of the identified problems is the market capture, so that those at the bottom of the pyramid do not get returns for their sweat and investment.
After years of borrowing to finance infrastructure projects like roads and railways, Kenya is now struggling to repay the debt. The current government under President William Ruto emphasizes the importance of robust revenue collection to service the country's debt and economic development. Samuel Nyandemo is an economics lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says the government needs to support citizens by reducing taxes on basic commodities to deal with this harsh economic period.
The president means well for this country. He needs to come out of the box, put away most of this appetite of borrowing with a fear of raising revenue, revert back to removing subsidies gradually, and more importantly, reducing certain taxes, particularly taxes relating to increasing the cost of living. We need to see a gradual removal of subsidies on unga, maize flour, on oil products, cooking oil, and more importantly, on fuel.
Kenya has had record high fuel prices this month, with gasoline reaching $1.42 per litre. That price has heightened concerns among an already financially burdened population. The government has asked for more time to restore economic stability after 10 years of borrowing, particularly from China. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
An Ethiopian digital app inventor, Eden Tedesi, has been given a prestigious award from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for creating an application designed to link refugees with employers. For VOA, Maya Masikir has the story from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
Last week in New York, Eden Taddesa accepted a Goalkeepers Global Goals Award at a ceremony attended by Kenyan President William Ruto, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and Bill and Melinda Gates, among others. Eden was given the award for her digital app Invicta, which connects refugees seeking jobs with employers. Invicta is credited with helping 2,500 refugees find employment, most of them in Africa and the Middle East. Through the app, 7,000 refugees have been able to continue their education by completing online courses. Mohammed Jamal al-Din, who left his hometown in Khartoum following the outbreak of war in Sudan, used Invicta to find work with a company in his profession of software and web development.
She told me that I could look into working as a software engineer and has been actively searching for opportunities for me. Every member of Invicta has been so friendly towards me.
The way it works, refugees or internally displaced people register with Invicta by filling out a form. The applications are assessed by a team, and selected candidates are trained and introduced to companies looking to fill positions. Eden says she came up with Invicta after her work supporting education at a refugee camp.
Once I arrived, I realized that refugees were incredibly talented and hardworking, and what they really needed was access to labor markets. And so that's what I wanted to do and wanted to help with.
The Goalkeepers Initiative is a campaign at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that promotes progress towards United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Blessing Omakwu, who leads the Goalkeepers Initiative, says the aim is to highlight people who are doing amazing work and to showcase progress.
And that's our goal, is for people to come here and know that the work that you are doing is seen and matters, is valuable, and is accelerating progress. So first, it's really a source of inspiring the people who are doing the work, both those we award.
For Eden, the honor also brought a personal reward, a prize of $20,000. Maya Misikir, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Tuareg-dominated separatist group said on Saturday that it had inflicted heavy losses on the Malian military in an attack in the troubled country's center. The rebels said they had counted 98 dead soldiers. The claim came in a statement from the Permanent Strategic Framework, which is dominated by the Coalition of Azawad Movement, or CMA, an alliance of predominantly Tuareg separatist groups. The rebels also said they had wounded dozens of soldiers, taking 5 prisoners, while losing 7 of their own fighters. The claims made by rebels and all sides involved in the fighting are difficult to verify because of the remoteness of the affected areas. Access to independent sources is complicated by the conflict. The Malian army had only acknowledged an assault on one of its camps in Diara in the Mopti region on Thursday without giving further details. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection Buffett. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Egypt club Zamalek staged a stunning comeback to defeat Djibouti visitors Atasola 4-1 on Saturday and secure a CAF Confederations Cup group stage place. The White Knights began the second leg of the final round qualifier trailing 2-0 after a shock loss in East Africa 2 weeks ago. Elsewhere in Uganda, KCCA beat Libya's Abu Salim 3-2 in the second leg at Kitende, but bowed out 5-4 on aggregates. In Tanzania, Malian club Stade Malien, winners of the 2009 Confederations Cup, scrapped into the group stage after a 3-1 defeat by Agil Nur of Burundi in Dar es Salaam. Other clubs who have booked their place in the group stage include Dreams of Ghana, Academy Sua of Guinea, Esperanca Sagaranda of Angola, and Libyan Dor of Al Hilal Benghazi and Abu Salim. In Nigeria, the Nigeria Premier Football League NPFL for the 2023-2024 season finally got underway on Saturday after suffering 2 postponements.
The new season was supposed to start on August 26th. However, it was moved to September 9th before it eventually commenced on Saturday, the 30th of September. The league's start date was delayed for a number of reasons, including the need to install AI cameras needed to stream the games and train the staff on how to operate them. Benga Elegbeleye is the chairman of the Nigeria Premier Football League.
In the weeks and months ahead, we promise to be providing policy guidelines and schemes aimed at making our league that which Nigerians will be proud of.
And now to Namibia, where the Namibia Aquatic Sports Federation annual National Short Course Swimming Championship ended on Sunday. Swimmers from all of Namibia's clubs participated in the championship after they took part in various short course swimming galas at various venues throughout the country, where local swimmers had the chance to qualify for the national championship. Namibian Olympic swimmer Philip Snidler expressed his admiration for the high level of competition and the impressive skills showcased at the Aquatic Sports Federation Short Course National Championship, which held at Swakopmund.
It's amazing to see we have such a young generation of swimmers at the moment coming up, and they're swimming incredible times. Good records are broken. We are very excited. We just so happy to see that swimming in Namibia is growing and just growing even more.
In tennis news, Tunisian's Ons Jabeur produced a dominant display to beat Diana Schneider 6-2, 6-1 in the Ningbo Open Final. It is her fifth Hologic WTA Tour title, second of 2023, and first of her career on hard courts at the Ningbo Open. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. He has 1 month's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, the General Assembly concluded its general debate. As usual, the president of the 78th General Assembly summed up what had transpired throughout the debate. It was a very accurate recording or summing up. However, there was something missing, something that is really very important. He did not mention that throughout the general debate, we saw surfacing what has become two divergences of each side giving it its own interpretation of what is happening in the world today. This attitude of having its own version of events has got to a point where it is difficult to look for reconciliation between the two parties. The Global North is convinced of its own assessment of events. Equally, the Global South is also convinced of its own assessment of events. This view or this occurrence was discussed in a very important book published in 1969 by a Canadian academic. It was called The Betrayal Within, referring to the League of Nations and its secretariat. That book pointed out that the second Secretary General of the League Secretariat betrayed its obligation by failing to reconcile and instead took a very partial attitude. And that in that well-researched book based on the archives of the major powers showed that that was the reason why the League of Nations and its secretariat collapsed. The United Nations Charter did take account of that event and made provisions under the new United Nations Charter where a Secretary General could play the significant role of behind-the-scenes negotiation, as was done by Sir Eric Drummond, the first Secretary General of the League of Nations Secretariat. And the man came, Dagamashel, who by his skill and enormous experience in diplomacy, as well as his profound integrity and determination to be impartial at all times, built up a credible international civil service, and that was why he was able to deal with many issues. For example, during those days of the Cold War, when the parties could not agree, they would often say, leave it to Dag, leave it to Dag Hammarskjöld, and he performed exceedingly well, together with a very proficient international civil service. And when he died in 1961, the grandfather of geopolitics globally, in fact, Hans Morgenthau, whose textbook, Politics Among Nations, educated thousands and thousands of diplomats and diplomatists, wrote in a magazine article, quote, "The United Nations of Dag Hammarskjöld is dead." However, Hammarskjöld left behind a legacy of good international civil servants such as Dr. Ralph Bunche. And they carried on the spirit of Dag Hammarskjöld. And though with some staggering, that framework continued to the end of the Cold War, and things began to go downhill. So what is required and what was done by Dag Hammarskjöld is for someone to be able to search for common ground. It is not easy, but this is the only hope if we are to avoid what happened in the interwar years 35 to 1940. There must be courage for someone to say to these two divergent narratives that there must be a coming together. And we must bear in mind that it is not enough if the United Nations lean to sometimes the side of the South owned ideas or the North. And people who have studied the UN for decades will tell you that today very few people expect any serious negotiations to be done in the United Nations. The divergent sides about their own analysis has made things so complicated that there should be very strong concern. Today, the two sides go to the UN or its multilateral agencies, not to look for common ground, but to recruit member states to their side of events. This is folly. And therefore, there's an urgent call for the United Nations to have the courage to try to bridge the wide gap between these two divergent sides. I thank you.
That was 1 month's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Baby, don't do me wrong. Baby, don't do me wrong. I love you till the whole round what I do. Oh, yeah.
Can't you see me crying about you, baby? Come on, baby. Come on, baby. And do right. Do right, 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 do right. And take me. Take me. And try me. One more time. One more time.
كان مكتوب من شيء
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a loose tooth will not rest until